Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, Wednesday, September 24th. And can you guys hear me in the back okay? Pretty much? No? Yeah? It's not on. Ah, there. Now it's on. Very good. All right, let's turn some of these lights down so that you can see the board. Good. All right, let's look at the schedule real quick. So today's the 24th. We're going to cover appendicular skeleton today in lecture, and there is still one remaining lab that has to take practicum one. That's the afternoon lab. And then next week, we just got lectures, no practicums, but do have lab quiz, right, but no practicum. We're going to cover joints and get into muscle tissue next week. So when is our next test? Oh, it's on a Monday, not a Wednesday this time. So that's on October 13th. So it is, what, 2 weeks away, 2.5 weeks away from today. So you still got some time. Now, to prepare for that exam, what would you really like to use as a guide? Yeah, the study guide. Just keep working on that study guide. Work those online questions, end of chapter questions, all that kind of stuff. All right. Anybody have a question on the schedule or what you should be working on? And of course, the videos in Blackboard won't hurt either. That will help you for the practicum, and it's good for the lecture test as well. All right, so I'll put that away. And I want to look at this slide right here. We're going to talk about appendicular skeleton, and so we got to really know what the appendicular skeleton is. All right, so the skeleton is just all the bones that make up your body plus cartilage. So how would you think of appendicular skeleton? It's just a part of the whole skeleton. How would you think of that? How would you think of appendicular skeleton? Would you think of all the bones in the body? No. It would just be, what, the bones that make up your upper appendage, right? You could say arm, but don't forget, arm is only between shoulder and elbow, but it also includes forearm, wrist, and digits, right? And then the lower appendage, which is your thigh and your leg, ankle and foot. But there's two other things as well, part of the appendicular skeleton. Right? And I see it on this slide, the hip bones. Right? We call that a girdle. It helps attach your lower appendage to the axial skeleton. A girdle is just something that completely surrounds something. So this is a girdle because it completely surrounds the pelvic cavity. And then the pectoral girdle. I see up here, it helps attach the upper appendage to the axial skeleton. And there are two bones there. There's a clavicle, which is anterior, and the scapula, which you can barely see. It's on the back, right? Okay, I just changed it. Here's the scapula. So scapula and clavicle make up the pectoral girdle. And these bones surround your upper thorax, and these things attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, so those are the things that we're going to be looking at today. Everything in that nice, I don't know, beige, greeny yellow. I don't know what color that is. But anyway, not the gray bones right there. All right. So anybody got a question on the appendicular skeleton? I think we're good. I'll just look real quick. Nobody's got a question. Nice. Well, what happened? Okay. Let me put this away. So we're done with that. I'll put this here, and here's your word slide. All right, so let's start working on the upper appendage, but before we get to the upper appendage long bones, let's talk about the girdle that attaches it to your axial skeleton. And it is the clavicle. Clavicle is kind of like an S-shaped bone, which is anterior. You don't have to know too many pieces of a clavicle, but you do have to know what end attaches to the sternum and what end attaches to the scapula, right? So one is what we call the sternal end, and the other is called the scapular end or acromial end, because this process on the scapula is called the acromion process. That's how this end got its name. Now, what's really illustrative on this particular illustration is that when you look at the clavicle on this illustration, it looks like both ends pretty much are the same. Right? As you get to the end, it kind of flares out. It gets a little bit wider on the sternal end and also on the acromial end. It also looks like it flares out and gets a little bit wider. So it's kind of hard to tell the difference, even if we just turn it upside down. But in lab, you're going to notice that this acromial end is really flat. The acromial end is flat, but the sternal end looks like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet. It just opens up 360 degrees. So that just illustrates the importance of going to lab and working with the models, because when you look at these two-dimensional pictures, you just don't get enough information to really know what the bones look like in real life. So you got to go to lab, pick those bones up, look at the ends, put it on your body the way it belongs, and then you probably have a pretty good idea of what that bone looks like. All right, so those are the two ends you have to know. And here's a conoid tubercle. And that is just for an attachment between this other process that's on the scapula. That's what we call the coracoid process. We're going to get to the scapula in just a little bit. All right, so that's the clavicle. There's a big, huge artery that goes right into the arm, and it goes right underneath the clavicle. Take a guess of what that artery is called. Take a guess. Take a wild guess. It's okay if you don't guess right. It's called sub, because it's underneath the clavicle. It's the subclavian artery. And if that artery is ever lacerated, certainly you would hemorrhage a lot, and chances are you would hemorrhage to death, right, because it's such a big artery. And the clavicle breaks fairly frequently, right, because it's so tightly wedged between the acromion process and the sternum right here that anytime you get a significant bump on your shoulder, the clavicle has no place to go except absorb all of that energy, and it fractures. But hardly anybody ever dies of hemorrhage when a clavicle breaks. And the reason why is because of the bend in the clavicle. When it fractures, it always breaks exteriorly. It never breaks interiorly and down to lacerate the subclavian artery. So that's particular why we see the shape that the clavicle has, right? Through evolution, it's just been selected out because it protects the subclavian artery. And I'm sure there's at least one student in here who has broken their clavicle, because it's fairly frequent. You usually don't cast the shoulder like we do for a lot of other bones, but the shoulder is immobilized in a sling, and we usually don't pay too much attention to that fracture. It usually heals very nice. But if you were to palpate, right, sometimes we call that the collarbone in just everyday language, the clavicle and collarbone. If you palpate somebody's clavicle that has broken it, you can feel a really sharp edge pointing anteriorly, right? And it's not of any clinical significance, but it is of cosmetic value for some people to actually get the clavicle shaved down in that region so they don't have this big sharp point sticking out where their collarbone will be. All right, so that's the clavicle. It makes part of, what does it make part of? It's part of the appendicular skeleton, but think of something smaller. It helps make up the pectoral girdle of the upper appendage. All right, so what's the other bone that makes up the pectoral girdle? Okay, and that is the scapula. And here I can see the scapula, right? It's on your back, it's posterior. So what side of the scapula are we looking at now on this illustration? And here is the whole skeleton. So we're looking through the thoracic cage from the anterior. So this is the anterior part of the scapula. But is it the superficial or the deep part? Yeah, the anterior part of this bone is the deep part. The posterior is the superficial part. All right, so I do want you to be aware of that. So when you get to lab next week, which is when we're going to do appendicular skeleton, definitely pick up a scapula, turn it around, put it on your body the way that it belongs correctly, and that will help orient you to these surfaces that I want you to look at. All right, so from that other figure, can you remember what view of the scapula, or where do I have the cursor? Is this the posterior or anterior part? Okay, yeah, this is the anterior, the deep part. And notice that it forms a bowl. What do we call a bowl once again? A fossa, that's right. And this one is called the subscapular fossa. This is the one on the anterior side. It's just a really big bowl. And now you know the name of the muscle that you find in this region. It is called the subscapularis. That's why it's really handy to know and remember all of your bones, because you'll use this for nerves and arteries and muscles through the rest of the semester. So sometimes anatomy gets easier the more you know anatomy, because things relate to each other a lot better. All right, so don't forget, fossa holds something. What is held here is the subscapularis. Right, but we're going to cover that in muscles. I don't know if muscles are on the next lecture exam or not, but anyway, bones are. Okay, so we see that it's kind of triangular shape, so there are some angles. The inferior angle is way down over here, superior angle is there, and there's a border between the inferior and superior angle. And this is confusing sometimes, because we want to know if this is medial or lateral. What border would this one be? This is the long border. This is the big one. Yeah, you would think it's the lateral border, but you know what? If we look over here, we're going to see a depression where the bone in your arm attaches, and so that is lateral. So this right here really is the medial border. When you look at this big long border, think of it lining up against all the spinous processes of your vertebral column, right? So medial border. Here is the lateral border, not as long, right? And remember, here is that glenoid cavity. Sometimes we call this a glenoid fossa. The head of the humerus articulates with the scapula. And of course, your arm isn't attached to you in the middle of your back. Your arm is attached to you where? Laterally. So that's why we know this is the lateral border right here. But definitely you got to see it the first time. So take this bone, put it on your body the way it belongs. And then here's the superior border, opposite the inferior angle. So glenoid cavity and glenoid fossa, pretty much the same name. And does this look like a really deep bowl, really deep depression, or kind of a shallow depression? It's kind of a shallow depression, and indeed it is. So that means that you have a lot of dexterity with your upper appendage. You can raise your arms over your head, behind your back, right? But there's a trade-off for that dexterity, for that range of motion. Can anybody think of what would be a bad thing that accompanies that large range of motion, which is what we would like? We would like to have a large range of motion, but what's the downside to having that? It just means, I think I heard the answer up there, it just means that the shoulder joint is not a very strong joint, right? Compared to another kind of joint that we're going to look at, and this is a ball and socket joint. You have one other ball and socket joint in your body that, as it turns out, is an extremely strong joint. So you can imagine then that the range of motion of that joint is going to be way reduced compared to the shoulder. So shoulder has a lot of range of motion, but because of that, that's a fairly weak joint. It can be damaged pretty easily. All right, let's look at a couple other processes. Coracoid process. Guess what the function of the coracoid process is? Muscle attachment, right? So just automatically think muscle attachment when you see process. Here's the acromion process. And again, muscle attachment, but there are also some ligaments between these bones. Okay, so this is the anterior side. Let's look at the posterior side. Again, here we see the inferior angle, superior angle. And now here I see two additional fossae. And they're separated by the spine, the scapular spine. And you can feel that on your back pretty easily, and you can feel the two muscles. So there are muscles in each of these fossa. Supra means what? What does supra mean, do you think? It means above. What does infra? Like below, like infraorbital foramen, supraorbital foramen, right around the orbit of the eye. So we name these fossa just that same way. So that's pretty easy to remember. And these fossa contain muscles. The muscle in the supraspinous fossa is the supraspinatus. So that's really handy to know. The muscle in the infraspinous fossa is the infraspinatus. That just means below the spine of the scapula. And as we move in this direction, which direction am I going, medial or laterally? Yeah, moving laterally, the spine gets bigger and thicker, and it finally ends up on the acromion process. And that's the most lateral part of the scapula, so that's why you know this is the lateral border. This vertical one here is the medial border, right up against the spinous processes of all your vertebrae. All right, and then here's another view of the coracoid process. And I maybe forgot to mention this little notch Since it's in the superior border, we call that the suprascapular notch. And pretty much every scapula is going to have that. I've never seen one with a foramen, so it's going to be a notch or just barely a notch in all of the scapulae that we look at. Okay, so here's a review. Questions. Kind of a trick question. Okay? And I would like to know, how many fossae do you see on the scapula? How many fossae do you have to know? So you think of it, think of that, you got that picture in your mind. I heard three. Do we have another one? Everybody agree with three? Okay. Well, let's count them. Supraspinous fossa, infraspinous fossa, the glenoid fossa, and also the subscapular fossa. So there are actually four. So in lab, take a look at those four. And it's kind of a trick question because on this illustration, the glenoid fossa is labeled glenoid cavity. And I think most people probably call it a fossa, not a cavity. So there are actually four. All right, so most of these fossa have a muscle. They hold a muscle, but the glenoid cavity holds the humerus, the head of the humerus. Okay, so this bone and another one help make up the pectoral girdle. What's the other bone that helps make up the pectoral girdle? The clavicle. Remember, clavicle is anterior, scapula is posterior, and they pretty much encircle your upper thoracic cavity. So that's why we call it a girdle. Okay, so the scapula it articulates with the clavicle, which is part of the appendicular skeleton. And here's another articulation, which articulates with the humerus, another part of the appendicular skeleton. So you might be wondering, where does this pectoral girdle articulate with your axial skeleton? Remember we said that a girdle is something that helps attach an appendage to the axial skeleton. And where the heck is that located at? Let's see if I have a good illustration. Pretty much. Here's a good one. All right, so appendicular skeleton, appendicular skeleton, appendicular skeleton, right? And the scapula does not articulate with the axial skeleton. It's only this little joint right here. This is the only joint that's holding your whole upper appendage to your axial skeleton, right? And sometimes we call that the claviculomanubrial joint. And it's just a really, really small joint. So what's really holding your upper appendage to your body are all of the muscles that attach to the thorax and then attach to the scapula or the humerus right here. It's just this little joint. All right, so that's kind of interesting to look at. All right, so that's the pectoral girdle. Next bone is going to be, here's a really good view of all four of the fossae, right? Subscapular fossa, infraspinous, supraspinous, and glenoid fossa. And on a practicum, of course, you could call it glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. It really doesn't matter so much. All right, so those pictures are really good. All right, the most proximal long bone in your upper appendage is the humerus, right? And indeed, that's in your arm between your shoulder and your elbow. There's some smooth articulating surfaces, and this is a nice convex surface. And if it's on an end of a bone, a nice convex surface like that, we usually call that the head of a bone. And it's smooth for articulation, so there's hyaline cartilage on top of that. This is the object that fits into that very shallow bowl that we call the glenoid fossa, the glenoid cavity. And you can see now that it's really a nice ball and socket joint. So you have all kinds of really nice range of motion at the shoulder. All right, so that is the, what is this, epiphysis or diaphysis? Yeah, epiphysis. And which one? It is the proximal epiphysis, right? Down over here is the distal epiphysis. And does the proximal and distal epiphysis look the same? No, they look a lot different. All right, so we're going to get to this distal epiphysis in just a second after we cover some other issues. What do we have between the epiphyses? We have the diaphysis. Yeah, it's just a diaphysis. Just use your nomenclature for a typical long bone. Okay, so generally that's what we're looking at. All right, so looking at the head, I see a small indentation right below the head of the humerus, and then the humerus gets a little bit bigger. So you could think of this as, this is the head. You could think of this as the shoulders, and that narrow part you're going to call the neck of the humerus. Right, so here is the neck of the humerus, and that's a pretty big, thick bone, pretty strong. We're going to call that the anatomical neck, as opposed to this area right here. And you can tell this is a lot narrower than the anatomic neck. And this is what we call the surgical neck of the humerus, because when somebody fractures a humerus, this is the location where there, it's a tendency to fracture, not up near the head, right? Because the head is still, this anatomic neck is still very large and strong. I see a couple other processes, and they're called tubercles. And you can see that they're very rough, and so that's for muscle attachment that helps attach your upper appendage to your body. And there is a depression between the tubercles. What's the name for a long depression, long narrow depression? It's got two names. You could call it a groove, you could call it sulcus, either one, that's fine. And since it goes between the tubercles, we call that the intertubercular sulcus. And a lot of people, when they hurt their shoulder, there's a big strong muscle that comes up through here, namely the biceps, part of the biceps. And it's pretty easy to damage the biceps and your shoulder joint, right, because that tendon goes right through this area right here. All right. Now, when you look at the humerus, just the proximal epiphysis, can you tell me which is medial, which one's lateral? Like, where do I have my cursor right now? Is this the medial part or the lateral part? Lateral, because the head is pointing medially, right, to articulate with the glenoid fossa. So here's the medial part, here's the lateral part. As we get to mid-diaphysis, we see a kind of a broad, rough area, and it's a raised area, so that's a process. It's got a name called a tuberosity. Tuberosity, just a little bit different than a tubercle. Oh, these tubercles, the greater one and lesser one. Maybe I forgot to mention that. The greater one just means bigger. The lesser one is a little bit smaller. The greater one is also lateral. The tuberosity is not nearly big as a tubercle, and it is facing laterally pretty much. And tell me the name of this tuberosity right here. Go ahead, say it out loud. Deltoid tuberosity. Now you know the name of a muscle that attaches to the humerus right here, and that is the deltoid muscle. That's right, the deltoid muscle that helps you, well, I'm going to say elevate your arm. That's not a proper anatomic term, but for today that works, right? So that's the deltoid muscle attaches right here. Okay. Now going down all the way to that distal epiphysis, we see that it looks a little bit more complicated compared to the proximal epiphysis. And before I get down over here, are there any questions? Anybody got a question about the diaphysis and the proximal epiphysis? That's not too bad, right? The head is just a nice ball and socket joint. Now, this part of the humerus, the distal epiphysis, helps make up what joint in your body? Can you picture what joint that is? Yeah, that's your elbow joint. Okay. And I see a couple condylar surfaces. I see one that looks very spherical. And what's the function of a condyle once again? Condyle for articulation. It helps make a joint. All right, so the head is really a condyle, smooth, covered with cartilage. The capitulum articulates with some bone, with a bone in your forearm. And then here's another condylar surface, the trochlea. And I do want you to know which one is medial and which one is lateral. So which one is going to be lateral? Is it the capitulum or trochlea? The capitulum, yeah, the spherical shaped one is going to be lateral. And you're going to see why that is in just a second. And the trochlea kind of reminds me of a spool or maybe a bobbin that you'd wind some thread up on. It's got on the edges, on the ends, it's got some wide parts, and in the middle it's kind of narrow, kind of reminds me of a little bobbin. That articulates with the second bone that's in your forearm. All right, so that's why we have these two special condyles, right, and they got special names because your elbow is a special joint. Because at your elbow, you don't know these definitions yet, but you can flex your elbow like that, you can extend your elbow, but what else can you do with the elbow? I'll demonstrate. You can position the palm of your hand posteriorly, or you can position it anteriorly, and what's moving is part of the bones in your elbow joint. So it's got to be kind of a special joint to be able to do that. All right. So I see some bony prominences that are superior to these condyles right here. So what do we call above? We could say supra, but there's another thing that means on top of. What's on top of the dermis? Epidermis, yeah, so epi also means on top of, right? So here is the epicondyle, because it's superior to these condyles. And of course, we know by looking at the head that this is the medial side of the humerus. So this is the medial epicondyle. Here is the lateral epicondyle over here. And I don't know if I have the, I probably don't have this in your lab list, but here is an extension of that epicondyle. Sometimes we would call that the supracondylar ridge, because it's more than just a bony prominence right here. Okay, I see some other things. I see these condyles. I see an epicondyle for muscle attachment. Do you see any bowls? Do you see any depressions? And there are two. Okay, here is the radial fossa, and here is the coronoid fossa. These are special places within the humerus that parts of the bones in your forearm have to fit into when you flex, when you bring your fist up to your shoulder like that. All right, there's some bones that would break, but they don't break because they can fit into these little fossae very easily. So this is what we call the radial fossa, because it's going to articulate, it's going to allow for a part of, and you can tell me the bone, it allows for a part of the radius bone to fit right in here. Right? And this is a coronoid fossa because the part of the ulna that we're going to look at in a second is called a coronoid process that has to fit in this region here. So it's really important when you get to lab, you get this humerus and those two bones in your forearm, put them together, make that joint, and then articulate them to see how they fit together just perfectly. It's just really amazing how these things fit together. Even though it looks a little awkward here on this illustration, but in lab you'll see that they just match up perfectly. All right, so here we have that intertubercular sulcus, and I want you to be able to tell me if this is the anterior side or posterior side of the humerus. Anterior side. So again, put this, model it on your body so that you can see which surface it is. So we want to look at the posterior surface. It's going to look a little bit different. So here is the posterior surface. I still see the proximal epiphysis with the head. Oh, now I can see the anatomic neck pretty easily on this slide. And now here the surgical neck is illustrated nicely for you. And laterally is the greater tubercle, deltoid tubercle, mid-diaphysis, right? And now I don't see the capitulum, but I do see some part of the trochlea. Right? So I still can see the trochlea. And here is another depression, and this one is really big. And another part of the ulna, namely the olecranon process, when you straighten your arm out like that, that's this point, but sometimes we bang on something, so bend your elbow all the way, that pointy end right there. What happens to that pointy end when you straighten your arm out all the way? What happens to it? You still feel that? I feel the point, and then what happens to it? What happens to it when you straighten your arm out? It disappears. I heard somebody say disappears. Yeah, it disappears, but of course you know it's still there. Where does it go? It goes into the olecranon fossa. And if that fossa wasn't there, then that olecranon fossa would have to break off, or maybe this part of the humerus would have to break. And of course, that's not realistic to expect that would happen. Okay, so trochlea and capitulum. Now, can you remember the trochlea is what? Medial or lateral? You know what? Medial or lateral? Trochlea. Medial, because here's the head, right? And then the capitulum is going to be right on the other side of this epicondyle, so that's lateral. All right. Okay, so here's a zoomed in region. And now we can see the two bones in the forearm. And I can still tell what's medial and lateral on this figure pretty easily. And I would like for you to recognize that as well. I no longer can see the head of the humerus, but I can see the two bones in the forearm. One is the radius, right here. Here is the ulna. And I just know that the radius is lateral. And remember, we said that the trochlea was medial, indeed. And here is the ulna. The ulna articulates with the trochlea. The head of the radius articulates with the capitulum. So this will take a little bit of practice for you to see this particular joint because of, well, the kinds of motions that it can produce has just special surfaces on it. All right, so lateral is radius, ulna is medial. So what's one easy way that some students can remember that? What's anatomic position? What should I do with my hands to be in anatomic position? Palms facing forward, that's right. When your palms are facing forward, those two bones are nice and parallel to each other. The radius and ulna are parallel, they don't cross over. And there are a lot of times you want to take somebody's pulse, like they count their heart rate, or maybe tell if their heart is beating, for instance. And where do you put your fingers? Over here by your little finger or over by the thumb? Yeah, over by the thumb. And can you palpate that nice artery that's bloop, 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 that's beating? Can you palpate that? Okay, and what is that? Is that the medial side or the lateral side of your forearm? Lateral, because that's your thumb. And a lot of times, what do we call that pulse? We call it the radial pulse, because it matches up with the radius bone that's lateral in your forearm. That's why we call it the radial pulse. Maybe some of you were wondering why that was. So again, right, it's that artery is the radial artery because it's associated with the radius bone. So again, you learn a lot about muscles and nerves and arteries by knowing something about bones. All right, so this bone, this joint right now is extended, the elbow is straight, but when you flex the elbow, then the head of the humerus has to fit into the radial fossa. And this bump right here, this is called the coronoid process of the ulna for muscle attachment, of course. And when you flex your elbow, this big bony prominence has to fit into the coronoid fossa right there. Okay, so make sure you do that in lab. All right, this is the posterior side of the elbow. This is the pointy part of your elbow. When you have it flexed like that, that's called the olecranon process. Big, powerful muscle attaches right there, namely the triceps. All right, and now you see when your elbow is straight, this big process right here disappears into the olecranon fossa of the humerus. All right, and so remember, is the ulna medial or lateral? Medial, lateral. It's medial. Yeah, it's over here. So the trochlea, remember, is medial. The capitulum, which I can just barely see a little bit of an edge over here, is lateral because the radius is lateral, like so. Okay, who's got a question on this elbow? First time you see it, it looks confusing, so you got to spend some time with this elbow in lab for sure. Okay, because of these special condylar surfaces. All right, so let's move on to some bones now in the forearm. And how many bones do you see? There are two. That's right, there are two. There's one medial and lateral. Lateral one is the radius, medial is ulna. The head of the radius right here, you'll find that it has a little depression in it that matches up with what articulating surface on the humerus. Okay, I don't know if you can tell me, if you can remember right now, but you'll remember in a little bit. It matches up with the one that looks like a sphere. It matches up with the capitulum. And this hook right here, and I can see there's a big line running through this hook. This matches up with the trochlea, which is medial, right? So ulna is medial, so is the trochlea. Radius, the head of the radius is lateral, so is the capitulum. All right, I see a ligament between these two bones. We call it interosseous membrane. This ligament does not restrict the motion. It helps stabilize the forearm joint a little bit, but it doesn't prevent you from turning the palms of your hand posteriorly or anteriorly like that. So this is still pretty much a freely movable joint. Let's see if I can get another perspective of this. Okay, let's look at the proximal end of the radius. So we're looking here in your forearm. Here's your thumb. So this is lateral. Here is medial. All right, so here is that tip of the elbow. When you flex your forearm like that, this is that pointy end that you see. And here is that hook that I was talking about. That hooks into the trochlea. And so since it hooks into the trochlea, we call this thing a notch, of course, because it's a notch, it's not a foramen. We call that the trochlear notch. What part of the humerus does the trochlear notch attach to? The trochlea, right? And the medial condyle on the humerus. Right, and then here's that coronoid process. So big, strong muscles attached to the coronoid process and the olecranon process. And then I see another smooth area here. And it's almost like a facet. It's a depression, has hyaline cartilage. It's a really super nice joint, freely movable joint. We call it the radial notch. Now, what bone are we looking at right now? this is the ulna, and here is the radial notch. So guess what? You could tell me the name of the bone that articulates right here. It's the radius, right? Remember, that's how we name sutures, for instance, or processes, right, in the skull. So again, we don't name this depression by the name of the bone, but by the name of the bone that articulates here. So this is the radial notch. And if we look at the illustration on the left, the arrow is pointing right to where this articulation is. This is where the head of the radius articulates so that the radius can actually pivot around the ulna at this particular joint for when you pronate and supinate. That's turning your palms of your hands forwards or anterior or posteriorly. So this trochlear notch articulates with the trochlea that I see right here. That's purely a hinge joint, right? So you can flex and extend your elbow. But what you pronate and supinate with is the radius. The capitulum and the head of the radius allows for a rotation. And when the radius rotates, it crosses over the top of the ulna. So I would like for you to see that in lab once again. So if the head of the radius is rotating, guess what? This down over here, the distal epiphysis, there should be rotation as well. Right? So the radius crosses over the ulna. This is going to be nice and round. I'm looking at the distal epiphysis of the ulna, and it's going to look a lot like the head of the radius. It's going to be round and smooth. And let's see if I have a nice picture of that someplace. Ah, here's the ulna. See how nice and round and smooth that is? It fits into a notch. We call that the ulnar notch. And you should be able to tell me the name of this bone. Is this the ulna right here?
No.
Nope. It is the radius, right? Because we name this notch by the name of the bone that articulates right here. So this is the ulnar notch on the radius. And then here are some articulating surfaces for bones in your wrist, because this is the distal epiphysis. Sometimes a pointy part of a bone, we call that the styloid process. Did you ever see a styloid process anywhere else? Yeah, temporal bone is a styloid process. Yeah, so here's a styloid process on the ulna, right? Because we're looking at the distal end. That little styloid process right there. All right, so when we look at the joint between the forearm and the wrist, which bone is bigger, more massive? The radius. Now, if we go to the proximal, the ulna is big and massive because of the olecranon process and coronoid process. But when we get down to the distal part of these bones, it's the radius, which is really strong. And that has some implication clinically, because when you trip and fall and you catch yourself with your hand, okay, then you have this big, massive bone, namely the radius, just bumping into all these little bones in the wrist. And guess what can happen? It's rare that the radius breaks, but it's pretty common that one of these wrist bones is going to break because the radius is big and strong. Okay? And I'll point that bone out to you in just a second. All right, so remember, the distal epiphysis of the radius is big and strong, almost like an anvil. And when you jam your hand up into it, it's very possible that these wrist bones are going to break, especially one in particular. All right, so let's see. Did I cover everything I wanted to cover with the bones? Pretty much. Olecranon process, posterior ulna. Here's the head of the radius that can rotate up against this nice articular surface in the ulna. What do we want to call that little facet, that little dimple in the ulna, since the radius articulates right there? That's the radial fossa, okay? And then what about down over here? Here's the radius. There's another nice facet right here for articulating with the head of the ulna. That is going to be the ulnar notch, right? Here's the radial notch. Here's the ulnar notch. Remember, they're on opposite bones. And even this doesn't look much like a styloid process, but we do call it a styloid process, even though it's big and broad. It's not nearly long and narrow like the styloid process on the ulna, but we still call that the styloid process on the radius. All right. Any questions on that so far? All right, so take a look at these pictures, because it might seem pretty easy when I talk about it. Okay, here's the wrist. And the wrist has eight bones in it. I'm not going to ask you to know all of the eight bones, but they're basically arranged in two rows. And what bone do I have right here? Radius, and here is the Alma, on. Here's something that happened that I said doesn't happen very often. What can you tell, if you look at this x-ray, this plain film, I see something kind of abnormal about the radius. Do you see this little line right through here? Do you see the surface coming out, and then there's this big step right there until you see that nice normal line on the radius right here? All right, so that's a fracture. What part of the radius has fractured? I told you that the radius doesn't fracture that often. Usually it's a wrist bone, but here I see a fracture of the radius. And what part of the radius is this right here? Looking at the ulna, what do we call this part of the ulna here? See that? See that white area right there? That's the styloid process on the ulna. So this is the styloid process of the radius that has fractured off. The bone right underneath is called the scaphoid. All right, so let's see if I can find that scaphoid for you. Okay. All right, here's, I'm sure this is a good exam figure. So here's the radius, nice styloid process. What is right underneath? This is the scaphoid. It has a very narrow part right in here, and that's another place that fractures very easily when you catch yourself. So scaphoid is the most easily damaged bone in the wrist, and of course you have a lot of dexterity in your wrist. That's good because of all these joints. Unfortunately, right in this area, there is a nutrient foramen. What's a nutrient foramen in a bone for? It brings nutrients into that bone. Remember, bone is a living tissue that has cells. What are the names of those living cells in bone? Osteocytes. Yeah, they need energy. They need oxygen, just like any other cell in your body. And when the scaphoid is fractured and that artery is broken, it has a tendency never to grow back into the scaphoid. So what happens to the scaphoid when it's broken? The tendency is for it to die because it loses its blood supply. And when a bone dies in your body, chances are it most likely it will just be resorbed. So it will be broken down into basic components of calcium and phosphorus now. So somebody is missing this bone in their wrist after it's broken, right? And can you imagine if we change the structure of the wrist, what are we changing? The function is going to change drastically as well. So I don't think anybody's got a good way to figure out how to get that normal function of a wrist back after the scaphoid fractures. All right, so that's the only one I want you to know. But all the bones of the wrist, I want you to know what they are called as a group. As a group, they are called carpals. All the bones in your wrist are carpals. All right, let's go a little bit more distal. What do you have just distal to your wrist? You have your hand. Okay, so your hand is a good term. And we got some bones. We got long bones in the hand. And of course, there are five of them. And they just have a number. They don't have a name. And we start counting with which one of your fingers? Your thumb. So thumb is number one. So we start laterally, right? And then number two, index finger, number two, three, four, five. Little finger is five. So you got to remember that order because we're going to be looking at these hand bones in lab as well. And so these we don't call carpals because where do we find carpals? In the wrist. These are what we call metacarpals. Yeah, is that labeled here? Oh yeah, here, metacarpals. Great. All right, so these are metacarpals one through five. And right in this area of the thumb, I see a couple little sesamoid bones. This is a nice normal place for sesamoid bones. Who remembers what the heck a sesamoid bone is? It's a bone that's completely surrounded by a tendon. Okay, so it's inside of a tendon. So there's a special tendon that comes up over through here, and in that tendon are these two bones, and it helps just adjust the angle of how that tendon pulls on this particular finger, which is your thumb. Now, in anatomy, we don't really call these fingers. Right, and we don't really call the ones on your feet toes. We like to call these things digits. Right, fingers and toes actually might be beneficial because then you know if you're talking about upper appendage, lower appendage, but they have the same name. Right, and so here is digit number one. Here's digit number two, digit number three. And digits are made up of some bones. Those bones we call phalanges. Right, so a digit and phalanges are different terms. Phalanges refers to bone, digit refers to that appendage. And one is called a phalanx. So here is a phalanx. here I see three phalanges. And if we look at digits 2, 3, 4, and 5, we can count how many phalanges are in each of these digits. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, 3. And so we just name them. Here is the proximal number 5 phalanx. Here's the middle number 5. Here is the distal number 5. And if we talk about it just like that, we know exactly what bone we're talking about. Now, the thumb is a little bit different. Who can see what the difference is in the number 1 digit compared to 2, 3, 4, and 5? I think I heard it. It only has 2 phalanges. Doesn't have 3. Right? Because this right here is what? A metacarpal makes your hand, but the thumb, your digit, only has a proximal. And then what are we going to call this one here? Yeah, we're going to call that the distal one. It doesn't have a middle phalanx. Right? So here is the proximal number 1. Here's the distal number 1 phalanx. That's exactly how we talk about these bones that make up. What are the three areas? We have the wrist, which is made up of carpals. We have the hand, which is made up of metacarpals. And we have digits that are made up of phalanges. Y'all see that? Yeah, that's pretty easy. I want you to look at it a couple times. All right, but don't forget about the scaphoid. All right, is the scaphoid medial or lateral? Lateral, because there's that radius right there. Right, so remember, radius is always lateral. All right, so that's the upper appendage. Who's got a question on upper appendage? Anybody? Yeah. Phalanx, phalanx, P-H-A-L-A-N-X, N-X, phalanx. Yeah, those are nice terms to know. All right, so I think we're ready to go to the lower appendage. Here's the lower appendage. You're going to see the arrangement is pretty similar to the upper appendage. One bone in the thigh, two bones in the leg, right, just like the arm and the forearm. And, of course, there has to be some bones that attach this lower appendage to your axial skeleton. Part of the axial skeleton would be the sacrum. And the bone that attaches it to the sacrum are what we call the os coxae bones. You could call them pelvic bones, right? One is an os coxa. The other, if you talk about both of them, os coxae would be A-E. And during development, an os coxae is actually made up of three different bones that fuse together. By what kind of process? Ossification, right? And the three bones, superiorly is what we call the ilium, most anterior is what we call the pubic bone, and then most inferiorly is the ischium. So you got to take a look at this one. This is another kind of weird one where you got to pick it up, turn it around, put it, model it on your body, and then you'll have a really good idea how it fits where it belongs. All right, so remember, pubic bone, anterior, ischium, inferior, and here I see a nice depression. All right, and this is the analog to the glenoid fossa that we saw on the scapula, but this is on an os coxae. So now you pretty much know that the head of the femur articulates in this depression here. And it's really a special depression, so we don't call it a fossa, we call it an acetabulum. Acetabulum is a fossa, right? It's just a special kind. There's only one in your body. Well, located bilaterally, there's two, but there's only one location for acetabulum, so no one ever gets confused that it is a fossa or not. Okay, so you got ilium, pubic, ischium. Ischium, this is called ischium because guess what bone you're sitting on right now? Are you sitting on your ilium? Are you sitting on your pubic bone? Are you sitting on your ischium? You're sitting on your ischium. And there is a process that happens when blood cannot get to a particular tissue. It becomes, we call it ischemic, right? When the heart becomes ischemic, that's really bad. That can even cause death or an infarction of the heart. So when you sit down and the ischium, it's sitting on top of some soft tissues and some muscles, and your whole body weight is pressing on them. Blood can't get into those tissues. So what happens to those tissues? It becomes ischemic, right? And so that's why we call this the ischium, because when we sit down, these tissues here become ischemic, not nearly as dangerous as if the heart becomes ischemic because it loses blood supply. Okay, so those are the ascaxe. Here's the sacrum we looked at already, right? These five fused vertebrae. Here's the promontory. There's the body of the sacrum. Here are the auricular surfaces of the sacrum, right on the other side. Oh, what did we call this on the sacrum? This area here and this area here. That's the ala. Yeah, remember, it's a wing or a fan, wing. That's a quiz for next week in lab. Okay. I see a hole. In part of the ischium and part of the pubic bone come together and form this hole. We're going to call that the obturator foramen. Obturator foramen. Where the pubic bones come together, we call that the pubic symphysis, the fibrocartilage. That's a pretty strong joint. Right, it can move. Right? Does anybody have an idea when this joint becomes very movable, highly movable? Yeah, during childbirth, during parturition. All right, so there are enzymes that break this fibrocartilage disc down so that the pubic bones can separate. And what does that do? That enlarges the birth canal, so it's easier to deliver. Right? It'd be really hard for the head of the fetus to fit right through this area here without this disarticulation. And then after childbirth, then those pubic bones do what? They come back together, mostly, but not exactly the way they were before then. Sometimes guys disarticulate this joint right here if they go through the handlebars of a motorcycle. Oh, then these bones can separate. And I'm not sure those bones ever come back together either very well. All right, so what else do I see? I see a depression. All right, so here's the anterior side of the ilium. I see a depression right here. What do we call a depression? Fossa. So this is what we call the iliac fossa because it's on the ilium. I see some points. Here's a point. Here's a point. These points we call prostheses or spines if they're narrow. And these two are on the ilium. So these are iliac spines. One is above the other. So here is the superior, and it's on the anterior side because that's what we're looking at. Superior anterior iliac spine. Here is another spine. It's anterior. It's superior, but it is inferior, right? So here's the inferior anterior iliac spine. So you got to really play around with these two bones, right, or this bone in lab so that you can see all these different points to it. Okay. What else do we see on this? Here is a nice rough surface. It's a raised area on the ilium, and it's really long, right? And kind of narrow. That's what we call a crest. A crest is a process, so there's muscle attachment here, iliac crest. I see a nice sacroiliac joint right here between the sacrum and the ilium. And we see acetabulum. Here's something nice. I don't see a lead line on pubic arch, but if we put these two pubic bones together, do you see this arch right here? I see an arch. That's the pubic arch. And that's going to be one really easy way that we can tell the difference between a male pelvis and a female pelvis, is by the nature of this arch, which we'll get to in just a little bit. Pubic crest is a process, right? A little tubercle, which is a little bit lateral to the crest for muscle attachment. All right. And here is something called the arcuate line. I see a line right here, arcuate line in the ilium coming all the way around. And you can make a continuation in your mind of that arcuate line going on to the pubic bone. This is what we call the pelvic brim. Okay, so down in this region below the pelvic brim, we have reproductive organs, right? And so this is what we call the true pelvis. Any volume, any part of your body below the pelvic rim is the true pelvis. But we could also consider the pelvic cavity starting at the iliac crest going down, all right, all the way down. And that's what we would call the false pelvis. So the false pelvis is in this area here, just different ways of, and the head contains different kinds of organs. All right, so this probably will be a lab quiz. I'm not going to ask you to draw this thing, but for sure label it. And we have two representations. We've got a medial and a lateral view. Right? Here is one, here is the other. And tell me one way that you could definitely tell me if this is medial or lateral. there's a really nice easy way to tell. Okay? Because on that os coxae, it articulates with the femur, which is the bone in your thigh. And where does it articulate? In the middle part of your pelvis or lateral part? Lateral, yeah, lateral, right? Just like the scapula. So here is that big depression that we call the acetabulum. And notice that, well, in lab you're going to notice that this is a very deep depression. Almost the whole head of the femur fits into this depression in an os coxae. All right, which means a couple things. What can you tell me about strength, since it's a deep depression? The head of the femur fits almost entirely in here, as opposed to the head of the humerus and the glenoid fossa was very shallow. Right, shoulder was weak. The hip joint is incredibly strong because this is a much stronger joint. But what was the trade-off? Strength and range of motion. So what are we giving away with our hip to make it strong? Yeah, range of motion, right? We can't do the things with our hip that we can do with our shoulder, right? Certainly without practice, right? Okay, so acetabulum. Also on this illustration, I can see the three bones that make up an os coxae, right? So here's a line of fusion in the acetabulum. Above that is the ilium, right? And then posterior to that is the ischium. And then anterior to that is the pubic bone. Do you see those three colors right there? I don't know. Looks like shades of the same color to me. Okay. So we looked at before on the anterior side, because here's that pubic bone. We looked at this inferior anterior iliac spine, the superior anterior iliac spine. We got a couple that's posterior as well. Here's the posterior superior iliac spine. Right, that's why we named these that way. Here's the posterior inferior iliac spine. And then what do we call this in a bone? Not a foramen, this is a notch. Right? And I see two of them. I see one here, and I see one here. And I want you to recognize, that's a nice landmark, that this is the posterior side of an os coxae. This is the greater sciatic notch. Here's the lesser sciatic notch. And these are really easy to see. Once you pick up one of these os coxae, turn it around. You're going to like these as really nice landmarks. And here's something that a lot of students miss on a test. Are you ready for this? What did we call these things? These are all iliac spines of one kind or another, right? Superior, inferior, anterior, or posterior, but they're all iliac spines. This thing here is also a spine, but is it on the ilium? It is not on the ilium. What bone is it on? Ischium. So would we want to call this an iliac spine? We would not. We want to call this the ischial spine, so there's only one, right? And it's pointing posterior, so don't confuse this with an iliac spine because it's really on the ischium. Okay, so here is that ala. We're looking at the lateral side. Here's the ala of the ilium. This doesn't form the fossa. The fossa is what? On the medial side of this bone. And I think that's everything on this bone. Oh, ischial tuberosity. You learned of a tuberosity before. What's the function of a tuberosity? Rough area, rough raised area on a bone. Muscle attachment. Yeah, big strong bone, big strong muscles attached to this big strong bone, of course. All right, let's look at the other side. Oops, next slide. All right, so here's the medial side. Here is that depression for holding pelvic organs. All right, this is still the ala, but when we look at this part of the ala, it forms a bowl, so we call this the iliac fossa. Here's the auricular surface for articulating with what bone? Remember, is this medial or lateral? Yeah, it's medial, so remember the sacrum articulates right here. And you can see the iliac spines once again, you can see the greater sciatic notch, a little bit of the lesser, in between the two is the ischial spine. Okay, here's the body of the ischium. Here's the body coming down like this, and then it makes a 90-degree bend. What do you call a 90-degree bend in the bone? A ramus. So here's the ischial ramus. Right? So here is the body of the pubic bone, and another 90-degree bend. So here is the ramus. So the rami come together right here. And so that's one good way to remember. Right? So here's the inferior ramus of the pubic bone. Here is the superior ramus. And then here is the articular surface for the pubic symphysis. And remember, there's fibrocartilage usually in there. All right, so this is kind of an odd bone to look at. I describe it to you, but it really won't make a whole lot of sense until you see it in lab, right?
Can you show us where it is?
Right here. Right here. Do I have a better picture? I don't have a picture of a skeleton. I closed that file already. If I get done with lecture, I'll be sure to go back and show you that whole skeleton once again. Okay. But in real life, where is it? It's right here. Your hips make up the ascoxae. All right. Maybe I'll talk about that slide in a little bit later. All right, so let's go to the femur. Here's the femur. Here is the head of the femur. Look how extensive the head is because it fits almost entirely within the acetabulum, so it's a very strong joint. And then here is a narrowing before we get to these points for muscle attachment. These are what we call trochanters, not tubercles. These are really big, huge processes for big, powerful muscles that attach. So here is the neck of the femur, and it's pretty narrow, so when a femur fractures, it can fracture in this region, so the femur doesn't have a surgical and anatomic neck. It just has a regular old neck because it has a tendency to fracture there. Greater trochanter, lesser trochanter. So if I look at this side of the femur, is this medial or lateral? Medial, yeah, because that's where the head of the femur is pointing. So the greater trochanter is more lateral. The lesser is a little bit more medial. Here is a line. A line is a raised area on a bone. It's not very prominent, but it is there, and it's rough. So it's for muscle attachment, linea aspera. And that's on the posterior side of this femur. I don't know if you have to know any of these intertrochanteric lines or depressions. I don't think you really have to know that. But if you do in lab, right, you'll be able to find it in your textbook. Take a close look at the head of the femur. I see a little depression. Can you see a little depression right there? I don't have another picture of it. You're going to see it in lab. There's a little pit right here, and there's a ligament that goes from the head of the femur into the acetabulum, which makes that joint strong, but also helps reduce the range of motion. Within that ligament, there is an artery, right, a nutrient artery. What does that do for the femur? Brings in oxygen and nutrients, nutrition, right? So that, remember, this is a living tissue. There are osteocytes right here. And when that ligament gets damaged, then blood supply can't get into the head of the femur. And guess what happens to the head of the femur? Yeah, it dies, and then it is resorbed. Right, so now you have this joint with a jagged edge of the femur poking up into the acetabulum. And what's a really good way to treat that besides opiates? How would you like to? How could you treat that? Yeah, a metal hip replacement. We call that a prosthesis, and that's a really, really a nice procedure, very successful kind of procedure. On an X-ray, you would just see this jagged edge of the femur, no nice round head, and so, well, clinically the patient will hardly be able to walk, of course, but you'll see that nice jagged edge, and that's usually due to damage to that artery that goes into the head of the femur. And there was a fantastic, amazing, just incredible athlete who played professional baseball and professional baseball in the same year. So it's really rare that anybody has enough ability to do that kind of thing because you've got to have different muscles and different ways of thinking and all that kind of stuff, right? And he was tackled one time, and that artery was damaged, the head of the femur then was dissolving away, but he wanted his hip back. So he got an artificial hip, and he was such a phenomenal athlete that he went back and played professional baseball even with an artificial hip. Anybody know who that was? He never went back and played football because he didn't want anybody crushing his hip again. But that was Herschel Walker, maybe before your time. But maybe you could do a Google on him if you're interested to know. But it's just so that's a very successful kind of surgery to go through. Nowadays, your recuperation time is really short. And you're up walking the very next day, as a matter of fact. You're not running around, but at least you're walking around. Okay, so that's what we call a hip replacement. All right, so on the diaphysis, you just have the linea aspera. Now, because at your knee, you can't pronate and supinate like you can with your forearm, that joint is a lot simpler. The knee joint is a lot simpler compared to the elbow. I just see that it has two condylar surfaces. Make sure you know which one is medial and lateral. Okay? And then here is a surface for the patella. The patella is another sesamoid bone right here. It's completely within a tendon. It rubs up against the femur. So since these are condyles, what do you call these rough areas above a condyle? Epicondyles, right? Medial and lateral epicondyle for muscle attachment. We have a notch between the condyles, so we call that the intercondylar notch or intercondylar fossa. We have some important ligaments in the next chapter we'll take a look at. So that's everything for the femur. Forearm has got two bones. The leg has two bones. And just like in the forearm, you got to just memorize, you got to be really familiar which one is medial and lateral. The two bones in your leg are the tibia and fibula. Maybe say it a bunch of times today. Tibia and fibula. Okay? Don't say tibula. A lot of people have a tendency to put an L in here, but don't put an L, right? The lateral bone is the fibula. And maybe that's good because there's an L in fibula. Maybe that's one easy way to remember, which means then the tibia is medial, right? The strongest one is the tibia. And here is, okay, the head of the tibia. That's what articulates with the condylar surfaces, the medial and lateral condyles of the femur. So it's got to be a big, strong joint. There's a little eminence right here, and these you could consider processes, but muscles don't attach there, but there are ligaments that attach right there. So this is a good exception to that rule. And the ligaments that attach there, everybody I think is familiar with, they're called the cruciate ligaments. Even though you didn't really know, maybe you heard of a cruciate ligament before. And cruciate means that they cross over each other. They form an X. So when we get to the knee joint, you're going to see that nice X. Okay, just down from the condyles on the tibia, we have a raised prominence. We call that the tibial tuberosity. Big, strong, powerful muscle attaches right there. Then we got the diaphysis, right? We got the articular surface. And then here is part of that ankle bone that sticks out. Okay, and it, remember, does it stick out medial or laterally right here? Medially. You can palpate that ankle bone on you really easily. It sticks way out. We call that a malleolus. A malleolus. It helps stabilize the ankle joint, but it's also for muscle attachment. The ankle fits right into this notch that's formed by the tibia and the fibula. So here is another malleolus, but remember, fibula is lateral, so here is the lateral malleolus. And then here's the fibula, here's the head of the fibula. And pretty much that's all there is to these bones. Not too complicated. Not as complicated as the radius and the ulna. Just got to know for sure which one is medial and lateral, because I'm sure you're going to be asked a malleolus one time. Here's a malleolus. Make sure you know which one is medial, which one is lateral. And there's an interosseous membrane just like in the forearm. All right, so in the upper appendage, what bones would be right in this area here? Carpals. Yeah, carpal. I heard carpals. But in the lower appendage, we don't call them carpals. We call them tarsals, right? Okay, tarsals. So here is a kind of a similar illustration. Here are the tarsals. There are eight of them. And I want you to know, not just one, I want you to know two in this area. Two that are really important. Here is your heel bone. When you walk, this bone strikes the ground. We call this the calcaneus. And I got the calcaneal tuberosity right here. Big, powerful muscles in the back of your leg attach here. And one above it is the talus. So talus and calcaneus, I want you to know. The talus fits up right in between the tibia and fibula. That forms a really nice, strong joint usually. All right, so all of these are tarsals. So what do we call these? The bones of the foot. Now, we're not in the ankle. Now we're in the foot. Those are? Not metacarpals, but metatarsals. And again, there's five of them, starting with the great toe, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Your little toe is number 5. And then here are the phalanges. And just like your thumb only has 2, your great toe only has 2. And in the rest of your digits, right, there are 3. Proximal, middle, and what is this one right here? Distal. Yeah, just that little tip one right there. And all of these you can see are long bones. They're not really long, but in one dimension they're a lot longer than the other. All right, so that's right there, the appendicular skeleton. I might want to review a couple things when we meet next time, but that's pretty much it. Those are things that you got to know. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace. So make sure you sign that, please. Does anybody have any questions over this stuff? You're good.